sandwich. Throw it, I say! Throw it!
The Guy James Show is on in less than 1 minute.
Fly! Fly, do you hear me? Give my creation life!
So this was fun.
You're going to like this.
Let go!
Right now!
Well, this is it.
Let's get this over with.
So this is good. We got progress.
Any questions before we proceed?
Give countdown. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
You have entered a restricted broadcast area. You have entered a restricted broadcast area.
Country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. I have a dream.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
And a hearty good afternoon to everybody. Glad you're along with us today here on the Guy James Show. So glad to have you along with us. We've got a lot to talk about today. We've got a great show for you, I think. We've got Jonathan Alter on today, going to talk about his new book, The Defining Moment. It's a fantastic new book explaining the first 100 days of the Roosevelt presidency. Some an insight that, that I haven't seen before, and I think you'll really enjoy it. Also, in the second hour, we're going to have another guest today, Stephanie Studebaker, who's running for the 3rd Congressional District of Ohio seat. And she's going to be with us around 4:05, I think it is. So she's going to talk about the district. She is running in the district that encompasses Dayton, Ohio, an area very, very hard hit by the tremendous job loss in Ohio. So lots to talk about today. We hope you'll stay with us for the entire program. I know a lot of you do, and it's so good to have you along with us each and every day. So many of you, a lot of you send email every single day, and we're glad to hear from you. I'm sorry I can't answer everything from everybody, but I do the best I can. So I don't know what to start off with today. There's so much going on right now. How do you keep up with it, everything? Yeah, I did find something interesting here at the very last minute before the program started today. Someone sent me something that is very, very thought-provoking. You know, we mentioned yesterday about this new deal, the Supreme Court, fools that they are now, having the right-wing slant. I think we got a little taste yesterday of how it's going to be from now on, whereas the cops now... If they have a search warrant, and I was remiss in saying that yesterday, if they have a search warrant, they don't have to knock on the door. They can just knock your door down and come in after you. Here, someone sent me an interesting question and made an interesting point. What happens if you live in the state of Florida? Now, as you all know, Florida, and I think Texas, and I'm not sure how many other states, we have a law here that if you are being threatened and you understand that you're being threatened, you can just pull a gun and shoot somebody. Do you know that? You can do that in Florida if you think you're being threatened by someone. I forget what it's called. I think it's the Castle Doctrine, something Castleman. Anyway, if you think you're being threatened, being bodily threatened, you can pull out a rod and shoot somebody if you want to. What if the cops come storming in the middle of the night and you pull out a gun and shoot one of them? What then? Of course, they're going to shoot you back and you're going to be dead. And all because they broke in your front door in the middle of the night. You would be somewhat startled. Probably your first reaction if you were a person that had a gun. I personally don't do that sort of thing, but lots of people do. And I think the first reaction for somebody that sleeps with a gun close to their bedside is someone came storming through the door to pick up the gun and shoot them. So, you know, what's the answer to that? I don't know. I wish I knew what the answer is. We'll, maybe somebody will, one of our lawyer friends will call and let us know. I just thought that was interesting. And I wonder if it's something the Supreme Court even thought of when they made their idiot ruling yesterday. And it truly is, well, it's just another one. Just another one. And it's going to be a long list of them coming up now. And, of course, there's so much going on right now. This obscene debate they had on the House floor yesterday, and the vote that the Senate had, and all. It's politics at its very worst. And when you take a good, cold, hard look at it, you might understand why some people are apathetic. You might understand it a little better. They look at what goes on and go, God, I don't know. I don't want to be a part of that. And then we have this amnesty thing come up today, and that's something that I think is very, very important. And I want to take a few minutes and talk about that today. We heard yesterday that according to Tony Snow, America's new darling in the White House, 2,500 American deaths in Iraq is only a number. That's what he said. It's just a number. Yeah, it's a number, all right. It's a shameful number. You'd never be able to prove it to me that the Bush administration has any concern whatsoever toward those 2,500 who've been killed in Iraq. What have they, you know, what concern have they shown? The wounded coming home, a lot of them are losing benefits. And so what do you know? The Republicans have now decided to use the Bush war as a weapon against the Democrats. A couple of weeks ago, who would have thought the Republicans would have the unmitigated gall to use the Bush war as a tool to defeat the Democrats? But, you know, when you stop and think about it, gall is their strong suit, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're attempting to turn the tables on the Democrats and once again make the Democrats out to be traitors, cowards, and soft on national defense. And you know what? They're getting away with it. They are getting away with it once again. And what are the Democrats doing about it? Almost nothing. They'll slink away into their corners once again and hope that the big, bad Republicans don't beat up on them too bad. In fact, 42 of them on the vote today did actually slink away to the corner and voted with the Republicans on that ridiculous, ridiculous non-binding measure. Absolutely absurd. But 42 Democrats were coward enough, couldn't stand up to the Republicans. Oh, no, please don't hurt me. I'll vote with you. That's exactly what happened today. And I don't give a damn. There's people going to write and say, oh, my congressman had to vote for it because they're on the edge with the, you know, I don't care. I don't care. If you're really concerned about that war, if you're really concerned about it, then vote your conscience. Forget about the politics of it. But then again, telling Republicans to, or telling politicians, most of them, to vote their conscience. Well, you know what I think about that. So, I don't know who I'm more ashamed of right now. The Republicans for resorting to this kind of cheap demagoguery, I guess it is. That's exactly what it is. Or the Democrats for not putting up a good fight, and they did not. But then I'm getting used to the Democrats acting like a bunch of whipped puppies all the time. The sole purpose, in case you didn't know, the sole purpose of that debacle on the House floor yesterday and today was to force the Democrats into either voting against it and then being castigated as weak on terror and masters of the cut and run, you know, all that sort of thing. This coming from many in the GOP who've never even seen combat themselves, or voting for it, the Democrats voting for it, and kind of affirming a link between Saddam and 9/11 while cutting off any future support for any deviation from Bush's stay forever strategy. So the Republicans put the Democrats in a position, and the Democrats allowed themselves to get in that position where it's one of those when did you quit beating your wife stories. There was no way out for them. Hell, some of the Republicans put up a better fight against what Boehner was trying to do than the Democrats did, at least, what, three of them anyway. And no thanks to the Democrats, the whole thing blew up in Boehner's face today when it was revealed that Iraqi Prime Minister al-Maliki, as some sort of a unification gamut, is planning to offer amnesty to insurgents if they lay down their arms and join the government, but only to insurgents who have killed Americans. That's right. only to the insurgents who have killed Americans, not Iraqis. There's no amnesty if they've killed Iraqis, but there can be amnesty if you've killed Americans. Now, this is, you know, this has drawn a deep and legitimate opposition from several GOP representatives in the House who really chafe at the idea that our government supporting an Iraqi leadership would, you know, that would bring the killers of our troops into their government. And even worse, we now find that it was the Bush administration that suggested the amnesty in the first place. That's right. Did you know that? In an interview in early April, Humam Hammoudi, a leader member of Iraq's largest Shiite religious party, said officials from the United States Embassy had raised the prospect of amnesty offers for those who had not killed innocent Iraqis. But nothing was mentioned about not giving that amnesty to those who had killed American soldiers. So the question has to be asked, why did our troops die so that their killers could not only escape justice, but to join the government overseeing their presence? And why the hell would Bush give amnesty to those who killed our kids over there? Once again, the Republicans are talking out of both sides of their lying mouths. On the one hand, they act like the tough guys who are really going to show those insurgents who's the boss. And on the other hand, they want to give amnesty to the people who killed our kids. But take it a little step farther. Why would the same Republican House majority that's opposed to amnesty for illegal immigrants turn around and accept amnesty for people who've killed some American troops? Does that make a damn bit of sense to you? You know, you might think it a bit inconsistent of them, but I think it goes a lot farther than that. I think it lays bare the highly questionable values of this administration and most of the Republicans in it. And if you dig a little deeper, I think you come to what I think is the inescapable conclusion that if the Republicans accept this amnesty proposal as reasonable, then they're acknowledging that we're in an illegal occupation where the killing of the occupiers is considered an acceptable act of resistance by the same people Rumsfeld originally called terrorist. And so Junior Bush is back on the offensive. After being pummeled for months about his illegal, immoral Bush war, he's now acting like the ultimate warrior again, and he's just beaming from ear to ear because he knows the media is painting him like some sort of Alexander the Great. He flies to Baghdad, gets his photo op, gives his puppet government a kiss on the cheek, and now he's Winston Churchill, Franklin Roosevelt, and Harry Truman all rolled into one again. And he's let the American people know that the troops will stay in Iraq as long as he damn well pleases, and that his stay the course bullshit is the way to go. And of course, the media is playing right along with this preposterous charade of his. They always do. After all, you wouldn't want your reporter to get shoved to the back row of the White House press conference, now would you? Now, good old Fox News, the White House official megaphone, is once again painting those who ask any hard questions at all about this whole circus act as some sort of unpatriotic folks. The White House is using the same techniques that were used to sell us this war by the White House Iraq group, strategic communication and disinformation, planting stories and shaping the coverage and framing. Note that the daily briefings from Baghdad have resumed. Did you notice that? And the Pentagon is supplying the GOP leadership with all of their talking points, making the argument that we can't leave Iraq without it becoming a haven for terrorists. Of course, the Republicans will never admit that Iraq is already a haven for terrorists, thanks to the botched job this administration has done administering their own war. And in what I believe to be, at least to my knowledge and anything I could find out today, in an unheard-of event, the Pentagon supplied the GOP members of Congress a 74-page memo outlining the huge successes of our military in Iraq. This is, as far as I know, this is absolutely unprecedented in the history of our country. The military getting openly involved in shaping the opinions of people in Congress. We're told all about the, you know, all the raids conducted in Iraq using intelligence gathered from al-Zarqawi. And we're once again being provided with body counts of how many have been captured. Yet no one noticed. No one noticed, as retired Colonel Sam Gardner has, that the document or the blueprint allegedly retrieved after al-Zarqawi was killed appears to be a forgery. Something that Gardner thinks was written by the American military's PR people, similar to what was done to sell us the war in the first place. So the campaign to sell us the need for a fraudulent war is now being repeated to sell us on the need to stay the course toward this glorious Bush victory in Iraq. And the reason for all this is very simple. Bush has no plans to withdraw our troops from Iraq, now or ever. He's convinced that victory is at hand in Iraq. Of course, he's delusional. He is dangerous. And now the White House has started a new media campaign designed to convince the public that Iraq is close to becoming the land of milk and honey, and that they had better keep the Republicans in power so that they can get the job done. That's what this is all about. Just 3 weeks ago, the puppet government in Iraq wanted the Americans out of their country. They said so. But now, after Bush visits them and tells them we'll hold their hand for as long as it takes, they want us to stay. Oh, yeah. Now they want us to stay. What has changed? Aside from the renewed Bush effort to prove he was right. You know, since the Democrats in Washington aren't willing to put up a decent fight on this issue, hell, their new campaign slogan, A New Direction, doesn't even mention the war. But unless the Dems decide to take a stand and fight, we're going to be in Iraq for a long, long time, regardless of what the Iraqis want and regardless of what our military can handle, because Junior Bush is wanting to prove that he was right all along and that we were not. And all of this is about nothing more than keeping this worthless jerk's legacy from going where it's headed now, down the toilet. That's what all of this is about. He will sacrifice another 2,500 people if he has to preserve whatever legacy he thinks it is that he has. If the Democrats don't hammer away at this lunacy, and if they don't ask the likes of James Sensenbrenner and Tom Tancredo and the rest of the anti-immigrant crowd why the Republicans would support amnesty for those who have killed American troops, but not for immigrants, then they don't deserve to take control of the government. Nobody is asking the hard questions. The Democrats, as our good friend Bart Kopp likes to say, is wearing their pink tutus again. Gosh, I hadn't thought about that for a long time, good old Bart. But they are. They're dressed up in their little pink tutus and said, you know, we'll dance for you. Please don't hurt us. Don't hurt us. We're just little Democrats and... Oh, I'm tired of it. I really am tired of it. And I'm sure a lot of you heard about that 74-page Pentagon propaganda that they put out the other day. They made it up in a hurry, and they sent it out to GOP congressional leaders. And also a few editors and reporters got a hold of it. But when word got out that the Republicans were being coached. Now, this is how sinister these people really are. You stop and think about this. They put out a 74-page media guide from the Pentagon, no less. And when word got out that they had done that, that the Republicans were actually being coached by the Pentagon sent out sent out an email trying to retract the guide. If you look in Google today, just about all reference to it's been expunged from the new search engine. CBS's Cheryl Atkinson mentioned the existence of the guide on the evening news, but apparently had been instructed to tone it down, don't use the term talking points, and point out that many of the issues the guide raised were factual. But CBS program managers had obviously not only received the guide, but also the Rumsfeld memos urging them either to not mention the guide or play it down. Can you see where we're headed here? a military man taking over the CIA. Now the Pentagon's advising Congress on how it ought to be. Do you see what's happening? Let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show. Hello? Well, I guess there's no one there. Have to call back, I guess. The little light was flashing. I don't know where they were. 866-546-5254 if you'd like to comment on anything I have to say today. 866-546-5254. Just as a quick aside here, how do you feel about the Patrick Kennedy deal? How do you feel about that? How do you feel about a United States congressman having the problem he does and remaining in Congress? I have a very, very sharp view of the whole thing, as you might expect. And I wonder how you feel about it. Is it okay for a congressman to continue to be your leader when he gets in that kind of trouble? Let us know what you think. Let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, Guy. This is Derek. I was there.
Oh, okay.
From Vermont. How you doing?
Hi.
I don't know. Boy, you're doing hot today. You got me convinced on the Lieberman thing. It's time to draw the line. Do you want to talk sometime?
Sure. I'm sorry? Hello?
Hi, Guy. How you doing?
I'm good.
You're good. You did a really great show yesterday that I picked up at probably about 3 o'clock this morning on White Rose.
What are you doing up at 3 o'clock?
Oh, I have sleep disorders. Plus, I had a bicycle accident 2 days ago, and my body was all banged up. In any event, I had some notes regarding your guest that you're having today, Mr. Alter.
Yes.
And I'm very, very looking forward to having the interview with you on him, concerning especially the Bush's Snoopgate article that he did on Newsweek on December 21st, 2005. If you could slip some of that stuff in, that's really great. Murtha's response to the Republicans yesterday was just classic. Keep it cool and throw it back. In terms of your perspective on the Senate and the House resolutions for promoting the war, I've come down to it. If the Democrats can't just hold the line right now, write somebody else in. I'm sorry. This is the point where there has just been too much over the line, and I think we really need to take control of what's going on there. Either that or shove it down the toilet someplace, because we can't sit there and do a Neville Chamberlain all the time with these guys. These guys aren't going to break with this.
Oh, good analogy. Neville Chamberlain Democrats. That's exactly right. You know, we heard early on when Bush first got elected that we were going to pick our battles. Well, when are they going to fight one? You know, they wouldn't fight anything, and they kept saying, "Well, we're going to pick our battles," and they haven't drawn a line in the sand yet that I can think of.
Well, they got to draw it now, because if they don't draw it someplace along the line, and I'm sorry, November could very well be too late to draw the line on this thing. I'm serious. I mean, especially with the voting machine problems that we're having and so on and so forth, and have had with H.R., what was it, 22, blah, 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 from the congressional resolution, you know, 4 years ago. I mean, these things, I mean, nobody's picking up the ball.
No.
I mean, I was, like, really impressed with Murtha yesterday. I mean, I watched a lot of it, didn't catch all of it. But, I mean, at least he sat there and didn't let them do talking points of, you know, somewhere in Normandy, or we'd be all speaking Japanese right now. And here's this man that you were talking about earlier that is definitely a 36, 37-year-old patriot of this country and has served this country quite well, and listening to some little ranky whoever it was that never did any time in Iraq, never did any time in Vietnam, was in the military, but really didn't put his life on the line to sit there and stand up for what our freedoms were. And I'm very concerned about some of the references with Mr. Alter. Hopefully you can address those in the article. I mean, basically, he was indicating that Bush thought that 9/11 gave him a license to act like a dictator. And I'm wondering in your interview whether you can interject, does he still believe in this? concerning the NSA, you know, the National Security Act of 1978, and classifying actions as secret, what Bush is doing now, he just violates everything along the line. So he doesn't really have to have any responsibility for everything. All he has to do is classify it. That keeps it private, keeps it out of the public eye, and that's not a national security risk. It's not a national security risk when George Bush wants to classify everything that he doesn't want the public to know about.
That's right. That's right. Well, I'll see how much I can get in today. Primarily, I know he wants to talk about his new book, The Defining Moment, and boy, what a book it is, by the way. Even if you're in a bookstore, take a look at the jacket on this book. It's really impressive. You know right off you're getting into something good. Eric, we're going to have to pause for a break. I'll try and get in what I can on that. I appreciate your perspective on everything. A great call, as always. And we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Keep up the good work, as always.
Thank you. Yes, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Alter in just a very, very short time. So hang on for that. Anybody talking? I'm looking at the email here. Didn't get one response on that about the Kennedy situation. How do you like it? He says he's taking personal responsibility. Isn't it easy to take personal responsibility after you've been caught and convicted? Isn't that kind of a hollow thing to say? I mean, don't get me wrong. I have compassion for him. I do. But please, after that, and accept our compassion and our concern and our care and our love. But don't stand up and be political about it and say, oh, I'm accepting responsibility now. You weren't until you got caught and convicted. That'll make some Kennedy people angry with me. And I've been a Kennedy person all my life. I've admired a great many people in the Kennedy family, but I just didn't like the way that was handled the other day. I don't know, something about it just rubbed me the wrong way. If we're going to talk about Limbaugh getting off with a slap on the hand and going right on with his career, then it would be hypocritical of us not to mention this as well. And I don't care which side of the aisle it is. I've got my opinions on it. And as you know, if I got the opinion, I'm going to put it out there. So there it is. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we are going to have an interview with Jonathan Alter about his new book, The Defining Moment. So we're going to pause for a break right now. And let me see here. Yes, we are going to pause for a break, and we'll be back in just a couple of moments. Don't go anywhere.
When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Strong evidence suggests that George Bush and Dick Cheney launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge, and tortured, targeted civilians, and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
Okay, listen up. If you're sick of hearing lies by right-wing corporate pukes who like to pretend they stand up for the working guy, then head over to the Cup of Joe radio show where the truth will hit you so hard you'll have to wear your hard hat. You can listen to the screaming audio at cupojoe.blogspot.com. That's cupojoe.blogspot.com. Now get back to work.
This is Noam Chomsky. Strong evidence suggests that the Bush administration launched an illegal war and lied to Congress, spied on Americans without court approval, leaked classified information, produced phony news reports, imprisoned without charge and tortured, targeted civilians and used illegal weapons. Ask your Congress member to co-sponsor House Resolution 635 for an investigation.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
This is Bruce Burch, and if you missed my show Sunday night, here's what I got up to.
A group of U.S. businessmen in the UAE said they will invite the Oprah Winfrey Show and other talk shows to the Gulf to change American public opinion, which has helped block Dubai's takeover of 6 U.S. ports. He's saying that they want to reach out to the average guy in the United States and explain why the UAE is important. If you want to reach out to the average guy in the United States, they need to send something, not Oprah. I mean, how many average guys do you know watch Oprah? I don't. If they want to reach out to the average guy in the United States, as much as I hate to say it, they need to send Jerry Springer and the Jerry Springer Show over there with the bald guy. You know, maybe they can do a UAE version of My Grandmother Is Also My Lover or something like that. Oh, this is just...
Join me, Bruce Birch, for All Things Reconsidered every Sunday evening, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern, allthingsreconsidered.org.
Yes, indeed, we are back, and glad to have all of you along with us this afternoon here on the Guy James Show. As promised, we promise you that we're going to have Jonathan Alter on, and he is with us. Are you not, Jonathan? Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
We invited you on today primarily to talk about your outrageously good new book.
Thank you.
First of all, who designed that jacket?
It was a woman named Jackie Seo at Simon & Schuster, and she did an absolutely outstanding job. It's really very classy looking, I think. And, you know, a lot of times book authors get upset when they see the jacket art, and I was the opposite. I was absolutely delighted by what a wonderful job they did on this, on the look of this book and the embossed cover and the uplifting picture of Franklin Roosevelt waving his hat, and it just worked out really nicely.
Oh, man, first impressions. when I got the copy of it and I opened up that package, it was like it just hit you right in the face. It was like, wow. And so congratulations to her on a great job on that. Jonathan, I want to start off today asking you something that's interesting to me. And of course, a lot of you know Jonathan's a senior editor at Newsweek, and you've seen him all over the place on TV many, 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 many times.
Too many.
you're a Harvard grad, are you not?
I am.
Ah, you Harvard guys. Anyway.
Don't hold it against me.
I won't. I'm not a Yale or anything. Well, the thing that interests me, first of all, about this book, there's been, God, I don't know, millions of pages written on Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, one of the most chronicled persons of our time, I'm sure. What gave you the courage to sit down and write about Franklin Roosevelt? Was there something there that you'd never seen in print before, or what started this whole thing?
Well, actually, what started it was in 1999. I did a piece for the Today Show where I moonlight for NBC News. It was a piece for Jeff Zucker, who now runs the joint. He was then the executive producer, and it was a series on the 20th century, and one of the pieces was on what were the great turning points, what-ifs of the 20th century. And, of course, you have, you know, what if John F. Kennedy had put up the bubble top in Dallas, or what if the Archduke Franz Ferdinand had turned left instead of right in Sarajevo, you know, that kind of thing. And one of them, which I knew just a little bit about, was what if Giuseppe Zangara, who got off 5 shots from 25 feet away from Franklin Roosevelt just 2 weeks before Roosevelt was sworn in at the depth of the Depression, what if Zangara had killed Roosevelt? And so I did the piece, and, you know, it sort of stuck in my mind as the most interesting of these, because the country was in the worst crisis when this assassination attempt happened. And I realized in looking at the Roosevelt books I had that it was a footnote or maybe a sentence or two in a biography of Roosevelt, because there were so many events in his life that most historians didn't have time to really look at events in any detail, especially events where something didn't happen. But I believe history sometimes what doesn't happen as well as what does. So I started to read more about the Zangara assassination attempt and sort of dug into it. And I found that the books about Roosevelt that had been written in the last 30 years, almost all of them were about World War II.
Yes.
You know, with the exception of a couple biographies that went by at 500 miles an hour, where the events of 1932 and 33 were just very sketchily referred to. and that there was some daylight, some fresh material in this period that I might be able to have access to. And then when I talked to James McGregor Burns, who's a great Roosevelt scholar, and he said, you know, if you do this, you will find new things. And at the time, I wasn't sure whether to believe him or not, but he turned out to be right.
Well, you're right about blazing past a lot of things, because if you wrote everything about a four-term president and a man with a life, interesting life even before that, you'd have a 10,000-page book, and you just couldn't do it. I found it so interesting that you really chose to concentrate on the first 100 days of Franklin D. Roosevelt's presidency. I don't think anybody's ever done that before.
Yeah, there's never been a book that's been explicitly devoted to that. And actually, despite the subtitle, less than half of my book is on the 100 days, because I got very interested in, you know, where did he get the confidence to pull off this conjuring act? And that was so I needed to devote 60 or 70 pages to the early part of his life. And then I started to focus very intently on how he became president in 1932, and then that horrible, just tension-filled, dramatic transition in 1932-33 between Herbert Hoover and FDR. And so, only about half the book is on the thrilling 100 days themselves.
Well, definitely a defining moment in history, 100 days, if you can call that a moment, a very defining moment in our history. I found it interesting that one of the things you mentioned in your book, forget what part of it, you talked about why FDR chose not to become a dictator. Can you explain that to people?
excuse me. At the time, in 1933, it's hard for us to imagine, but the word dictator had a positive connotation. Mussolini was very popular, not just in Italy, but in the United States. William Randolph Hearst made a movie called Gabriel Over the White House, starring Walter Huston, father of John, grandfather of Angelica, in which a good dictator lines up his enemies in front of a firing squad as president, dissolves Congress, and at the end of the movie is seen as a hero. And this was Hearst's way of trying to instruct Roosevelt on becoming a dictator. The New York Daily News ran a headline over an editorial, Wanted a Dictator, and there were other such headlines. The premier columnist of the day, Walter Lippmann, approached Roosevelt a couple of weeks before the inauguration and said, Franklin, you may have to assume dictatorial powers. And Roosevelt himself was tempted. I found a document in an obscure file in the Roosevelt Library of, something that didn't happen, a draft of remarks to the American Legion on the radio on FDR's first day in office, where he basically establishes a Mussolini-style private army to be at his beck and call. But Roosevelt decided not to deliver that version of the speech, and he passed word through Felix Frankfurter, later on the Supreme Court, on Capitol Hill in the first week of his presidency, you know, never mind what Lippmann is writing in his columns, I'm not going to be a dictator, and what I do, I'm going to do through you, the Congress. And he decided that he was going to work with the Congress. Now, if the Congress had balked, and they didn't rubber stamp everything he did, but they were mostly cooperative, if they had balked, he might have assumed some dictatorial powers, because he reserved to himself his inaugural address. He suggested that he might go on a wartime footing if if necessary, but it didn't prove necessary, and he actually, for the rest of his presidency, although he was often called a dictator, when dictator took on a negative connotation about a year later after Hitler had been in for a while, he never actually assumed dictatorial powers. And even the court packing scheme in 1937 was not dictatorial. It was just a dumb idea that he presented to the Congress and the Congress rejected.
I would say up until today, Franklin Roosevelt probably only the only president in our history that it could have come close to grabbing power like that. Is he not? Is he the only one that ever could have become a dictator in the history of a country?
Well, you know, it depends how you define dictator. I mean, Abraham Lincoln suspended the writ of habeas corpus.
Yes.
And, you know, through some editors of what were called Copperhead, you know, pro-Confederate papers in jail. We never had anybody who suspended elections or really became a European-style dictator. I think the conditions of the country, which were the worst in American history in early 1933, 80% unemployment in some areas, brought us closer than ever to dictatorship because people were so desperate and had so given up on the system. If Roosevelt had not been a success, we would have had a different country. Roosevelt was approached by a reporter in the early days of his presidency, and the reporter said, "Mr. President, if you are successful, you'll be our greatest president, and if you fail, you'll be our worst president." And Roosevelt replied, "If I fail, I'll be our last president."
That's quite a statement. That's quite a statement. You brought out a Roosevelt that a lot of people don't necessarily know. They've always seen this warm and smiling and loving grandfatherly Franklin Roosevelt, and he was that. Indeed, he was that. But also, he had another side to him that I don't know whether it's he didn't trust people or what, but how he kind of kept everybody away and made most of his own decision. He didn't depend on an army of advisors like so many people did. Evidently, the man was absolutely brilliant.
Well, he wasn't brilliant in an intellectual sense. He was much, much less intelligent than, say, Herbert Hoover, as well as a number of other American presidents. He wasn't, a political theorist like Woodrow Wilson or, an engineer like Hoover, Jimmy Carter. And he didn't even have the IQ of several other presidents. He certainly wasn't as intelligent as Bill Clinton.
But he had the savvy and the cunning, yes. Political.
He was a political genius.
Yes.
And he not just a native-born political genius. I think it was something that he developed over time. And I devote a good bit of space to, you know, his own political development and where he got the political antenna. And some of it was connected to his experience with polio during the 1920s. And he did keep everybody at bay. He described himself as a juggler. "My left hand doesn't know what my right hand is doing." It was one of his cabinet secretaries, Henry Wallace, said, "Yeah, he was a juggler. He kept everybody's balls up in the air except his own." he was very instinctive and improvisational. He didn't plan things ahead that much, but he had great vision in a larger sense, and he had the political know-how to execute. And I think that's what a number of his successors have lacked. So he had great political sophistication, and he understood how to get the best out of people. He never really trusted anybody too much, and I think that does come from the polio experience, where he got a lot of bad medical advice. And after that point, he said, "You know, I'm not going to really subcontract major decisions to so-called experts." And he played experts off against each other a lot.
He's a man that, to people of my generation, I've got a few years on you, I think, but to people of my generation, and especially like my father's generation, people of that age, Roosevelt was a figure that was either loved or hated. I don't think I ever met anybody of the older generation who said, "Well, I kind of liked Roosevelt.
That's a good point.
I don't think I ever met a single person like that.
Well, yes, the people who hated him really despised him, but it's important, and they wrote vicious things about him, more vicious than a lot of what's written today. But it's important to remember that the vast majority of people for his entire 12 years in office liked him. You know, he never was polling was really only starting in this period, but he never was below 50% in the polls, and you know, often he would be up in the 70s or 80s. So there was never a time when the country as a whole really turned against him. It was, Republicans were totally dominated by him, and the wealthy didn't like him because he did things like raise their taxes to pay for World War II. You know?
Well, how dare they? Yeah,
and
how dare
the other thing that happened was that they were just very, very ungrateful to him for what he did to save their fortunes in 1933, because he saved capitalism. Just to give you one example, in the first 100 days, it was strongly suggested to him that he nationalize the banks. That's what the New Dealers, his own people, wanted him to nationalize the banks. The fallback position were postal banks. Can you imagine that, if the post offices had run the banks?
Yeah.
He decided that he would keep banking in private hands and do the more conservative things, thereby saving the fortunes of the wealthy. But they showed no gratitude. And, you know, a few years later, when he was running for re-election, he was overwhelmingly re-elected. One of the biggest landslides in American history, carried all but two states. And he said that the wealthy reminded him of a drowning man, and a lifeguard saves the drowning man in a silk hat. And 4 years later, the once drowning man in a silk hat comes back to the lifeguard and says, "Where's my hat?" You know, there was just no gratitude at all for what he had done. And so some of the people who hated Roosevelt were people who took it for granted or somehow didn't accept the fact that he had saved them, and retreated into a kind of a bitterness that just got worse over the years, although many of them nonetheless united behind him during World War II.
Well, you know, it's a real testament to his, and I'll say it, I mean, I'm partial to Franklin Roosevelt, to his greatness, I think. We talk so many times, and we're in the middle of a situation right now where a man's having great difficulty in his second term. Roosevelt's the only person we've ever been able to measure in a third and a fourth term. But imagine having the power to go through a second term and survive that, and in a third term. The politicians we have today, I think, if they're having all this god-awful trouble in a second term, imagine what a third would be like.
Well, it could be better, because Roosevelt's third term was better than his second. He had a lot of trouble in his second term. He made some mistakes. He tried to purge disloyal Democrats. That failed in the midterms. He lost 71 seats in the 1938 midterm elections in the sixth year of his presidency. And tried to pack the Supreme Court. He did some dumb things, and I think a lot of people didn't want him to have a third term, and it was only because France and other parts of Europe had fallen to the Nazis that people felt like, you know, maybe we better stick with Roosevelt. Otherwise, Democrats wouldn't have renominated him for a third term. There was a lot of discomfort with it, and a lot of no third term buttons around. So he was able to redeem himself with that third term, and then, of course, they changed the Constitution, so it's no longer possible.
Sure. Now, I was worried for a while that they'd try and change it back during the situation we're in now, but I don't think it's going to happen.
I don't think you have to worry about that one.
One of our favorite people on this program has been over the years is a gentleman by the name of Mario Cuomo. And I was, I want to just...
He gave me a nice blurb for my book.
I tried to get a hold of him today because I wanted to ask him about it and then confront you with what he'd had to say. But I read where he said that FDR transformed us into, and of course putting it as only Mario Cuomo can, it transformed us into a more inclusive, generous, and successful nation than the Constitution and the markets could have produced without him. Can you explain that for Mario?
Yes, I think that what happened was that under Roosevelt, or I should say, I can try to explain it for Mario Cuomo, because it's hard for anybody to be as eloquent as the former governor on a subject like this.
Indeed it is.
What I would say is that Roosevelt changed the social contract under which we live. And it was every man for himself, and he changed it to a nation with where we are concerned with one another and are all in this together. And there were a lot of missteps in the process of doing that. And the safety net that was attached to the ship of state in this period I call the defining moment had holes in it. But the general sense of direction changed. And we are now again debating some of these very fundamental issues about what we owe each other.
Yes.
And in that sense, Roosevelt's example is relevant. I think that some of this has been settled and really is not being re-argued. And just to give you one quick example, after Hurricane Katrina, there was a lot of talk about President Bush not responding fast enough. Nobody, even those on the far right, nobody suggested that it was none of Washington's business if people were drowning in Louisiana. Before the defining moment, before Franklin Roosevelt, many people would argue, did argue, that if you were starving or drowning, it was your problem, and that the government could maybe help with some voluntary efforts, but it had no responsibility to come to your aid.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big change.
Huge, huge, and probably one of the reasons why the man is still vilified today in the halls of some Republican offices anyway.
They don't publicly say
no.
It's none of Washington's business. Nobody dares that to say that because we have a consensus. When they try to attack the bedrock of what FDR believed in, like on Social Security, they get their heads handed to them. It's now the idea that people should not have to worry about starving in old age is now in the DNA of the American people.
Yes.
And so even if they could maximize returns, you know, and with privatization, or you know, if they could get more for themselves, they don't want to have to take the risk. And that's the legacy of FDR.
Well, and a wonderful legacy it is. Like you just mentioned there's a man that whether they wanted to or not, made the United States of America have a conscience, or else the government have a conscience anyway. And
a lot of people are wondering, you know, where is that going to come from again? I think we can find it again. But one of the interesting things for me is that, you know, while a lot of people have bought this book for Father's Day, a lot more people have bought it for their kids because they want to remind them of what great leadership feels like, smells like, tastes like, and to explain to people in their own family and succeeding generations that leadership does make a difference.
Well, I think you just touched on it a moment ago, and I know we've only got a couple of minutes left, but you touched upon it a moment ago that perhaps we might be, and it wasn't your words, but we might be at another one of these crossroads in history right now where our society, and at least a certain portion of our society, is wanting to forego the things that the government the conscience of the government to help people who are starving or hurting or whatever. And some of those debates are taking place again. And, will we have a leader step forward like a Franklin Roosevelt again and say, hey, no, this is what we must do?
I think we will find that leadership. I do believe that. And that one of the things the book tries to do is to show that many Democrats didn't think Roosevelt was that leader in 1932 before the convention. He was just barely nominated on the fourth ballot. Many of them thought he was too unprincipled, weak, too much of a flip-flopper. So I try to demarbleize Roosevelt a little bit, excuse me, as a way of explaining Well, it's because I think it's very interesting that he was so disregarded and considered such a lightweight, but also as a way of telling modern readers, hey, leadership comes from unusual places, and some of these candidates that we're looking at, they might have qualities that we don't see yet.
Exactly. That's good. That's a great point. Jonathan, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to highly recommend this book, The Defining Moment. It's a great read. It's a book where you get your money's worth. It's a big book.
Not too big. It's under 400 pages.
Well under 400 pages, but it's not like some of these ones that you see on the market by some Johnny-come-lately right-wingers that get out these little tiny books nowadays and hit number one on the bestseller. You know who I'm talking about, so I won't go any further about it. So, anyway.
No comment.
No comment. All right. Jonathan, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Jonathan Alder, thank you so much for being on the Guy James Show today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Guy.
Yes, indeed. A real book. A real book where, you know, and he didn't want to mention he is a gentleman. Talking about some of these books that come out. You get your Ann Coulter put out these books nowadays. I don't know how many pages that filth was, the latest one that she's got out, but, you know, hardly worth the money. And the money is what it's all about. Jonathan Alder has written a masterpiece here. And for those of you who are Roosevelt fans, and I am one, and I thought I knew everything that had been printed about Roosevelt. Truly, I did. There's a whole new perspective on Franklin Roosevelt. There's a whole other chapter or two you will see here about the man. One of the great men, not just in the history of this country, but probably most likely in the history of humanity. Franklin Roosevelt, and there's a Republican sitting out there listening to this right now. They're, oh, my God, are you serious talking about that Franklin Roosevelt that way? He brought on us these social programs. And yeah, he did. At a time when we desperately needed him, and he is a man who gave conscience to the American government, and I will be forever grateful to him, and we, all of us as Americans, should be grateful for giving a country that, before Franklin Roosevelt, as Jonathan explained, was able to just look at everybody and say, well, buddy, I'm really sorry, but sorry about your luck, you know. So, hey, let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Hi, is this Guy?
Yes.
Hi, this is Jared from the Studebaker campaign. How you doing?
Hi, Jared.
I'm just calling to let you know I need you to patch Stephanie in on a different number now. Our office phones just went down.
Oh, okay. Well, hang on. I'll put you on. We're on the air, and I'll have
if
to.
If you want, you can just keep this live, and I'll hand it over to Stephanie, and you can bring her on whenever you're ready.
Okay, I will do that. Thank you.
Okay.
Never know what's going to happen on live radio, do you? Yeah, their phones went down. So we're going to have Stephanie Studebaker on in just a couple of minutes. She's running for the 3rd Congressional District seat for Congress, the United States Congress. And it's going to be interesting to talk to her. She lives in an area, Dayton, Ohio, an area I'm very familiar with. I'm familiar with all of Ohio, actually, ex-Buckeye, but know the state very, very well. And Dayton, Ohio, in that particular area, is hit very, very hard right now, as Sherrod Brown was telling us about yesterday, about the area that he's in up there being hit hard. And, oh, yes, you know, Ohio went red in the last election. Things were just peachy keen up there, weren't they? Mm-hmm. And we tried to tell you. We tried to tell you, but you wouldn't listen. A lot of you wouldn't listen. And so that state, by a narrow margin, went red. And there are a lot of people sorry, and it's not going to go red the next time. I won't put my personal guarantee on that, but I think it's likely that if the Democrats get out a good candidate in 2008, why, we'll take that state, and we think Sherrod Brown's going to take the Senate seat away from Mike DeWine. So, God, I hope so. I really hope so. If there's anybody who deserves to be out of the Senate, Mikey DeWine is certainly one of me. Bush bootlicker, an official bootlicker. That's what Mikey DeWine has been. And, of course, he's not all that, he's from an area not all that far from Dayton, Ohio. Maybe we can get Stephanie Studebaker to talk about that, too, although that's not her race. A lot to talk about today. What did you think about the Don Imus and Tony Snow talk this morning, calling Jimmy Carter a dope? Don Imus calling anybody a dope? Would someone please explain to me? Could you please explain to me anything redeeming at all about Don Imus's radio show. I know I'm in the same business. I shouldn't throw stones. But for many, many years now, I've looked at that Don Imus affair and gone, what in the world does someone listen to that program for? I've never quite been able to. I just don't get it. I really don't. But Don Imus calling Jimmy Carter dope. Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to pause for news at the top of the hour, and when we come back, we're going to have Stephanie Studebaker with us. And so don't go anywhere. It's going to be an interesting time. You're listening to The Guy James Show, and we'll be right back after the news.
This is Quality News Network. The House of Representatives has passed a non-binding resolution declaring that an arbitrary date for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq is not in the national interest. House Democrats are denouncing the measure as a political sham. The vote was 256 to 153 and follows a Senate vote yesterday against calling for the pullout of troops by the end of the year. Louisiana Congressman William Jefferson has been stripped of his seat on the House Ways and Means Committee, the full House voting today by unanimous consent following the recommendation of the Democratic caucus. He's in the midst of a government bribery investigation, but has not been charged and maintains his innocence. Democrats say he'll be able to reclaim his seat on the committee if his legal problems are resolved. Despite a major security crackdown, an Iraqi suicide bomber has killed at least 10 and wounded another 25 inside a Baghdad Shiite mosque an hour before morning prayers today. It's the same mosque attacked by bombers in April when 80 were killed and 175 wounded. AP reports that North Korea is accelerating preparations for testing a missile that has the potential to strike the United States. Officials are quoted as saying that the test of a long-range missile may be imminent. Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says that a set of incentives and penalties aimed at persuading Tehran to curtail its nuclear programs is a positive step, but he's leaving open how he will officially respond and has given no indication when that will happen and what Iran's counteroffers might be. South Africa is observing the 30th anniversary of the Soweto Uprising, a watershed in the anti-apartheid struggle, when hundreds of children protesting the forced teaching of Afrikaans and the poor education system were killed in a brutal police crackdown. Chinese authorities are continuing to try and slow the spread of a toxic spill of 60 tons of coal tar into the Dasha River in northern China. European Union leaders have endorsed an estimated $126 million aid package to the Palestinians, money that will be earmarked for the health sector, essential utilities, including fuel, and a social safety net for needy individuals. A federal court has handed down Vermont's first death sentence in almost 50 years to a man convicted of abducting and killing a woman in New York and then crossing state lines into Vermont, making it a federal crime. Vermont has no death penalty for state crimes. Have overwhelmingly approved a new English translation for Mass that would change key prayers spoken by millions of American parishioners. The changes must still go through the Holy See for final approval, a process that could take years. This is Quality News Network. It's now 2.5 minutes past the hour.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of hostility. You married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than the months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. collaborativedivorce.tv.
Air Canada has inaugurated a daily nonstop service from Denver to Montreal, becoming the only airline to do so. Microsoft is preparing to compete against Apple's iPod digital entertainment device and iTunes service. Reuters reporting that Microsoft has already held licensing discussions with the music industry to create its own music service. Microsoft founder Bill Gates says he plans to give up the daily running of his company by July of 2008 in order to concentrate on his foundation's work tackling health and education problems. Researchers at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine say that eating fewer calories may help prevent the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. They say a study in mice indicates that a lower-calorie diet can help trigger the production of a protein that protects the brain from the disease. Fed Chief Ben Bernanke says that prices are likely to stay high and that the central bank will be vigilant against inflation. Meanwhile, the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis saying today that the Fed may have to keep raising interest rates if inflation persists in the U.S. economy. French President Jacques Chirac says he has full confidence in aircraft manufacturer Airbus, despite announced delays in the delivery of its A380 Super Jumbo jet, which caused a sharp plunge in its stock yesterday. Light sweet crude oil is trading this hour at $69.80 a barrel, up 30 cents from yesterday. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials are down 9 points, NASDAQ is down by 14, and the S&P 500 is off by 6. More at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Diana Walter. It's now 5 minutes past the hour.
This is the Guy James Show.
The world is getting older. There's a few things to be said. Do you believe the things they told you? Do you believe the things you read?
The Guy James Show, America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Ah, yes, we're back, and glad to be back after the news, always. And we've, I don't know, hope I'm not having any phone trouble here. We had, are you with us there?
Hi, this is Stephanie.
Well, hi, Stephanie. We're so glad to have you on the program today. I hear you guys have phone trouble there, so it was good that you called in and used our studio line here. Glad to have you along with us today. Stephanie, you're running for the 3rd Congressional District in Ohio, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
And that takes...
It takes in Montgomery County, which that state in Ohio, Northern Warren County, all of Clinton County, and all of Highland County.
All right. And a very populous area. What is the approximate population of that area? Do you know?
We have over 300,000 registered voters in the entire district.
I see. Okay. And your opponent, of course, is a Republican, an incumbent?
Yes. He is in his second term.
Second term. Okay. Well, we're going to try and get him out of there, certainly. Stephanie, tell us a little bit about your district. What kind of problems do you have there right now? Why do we need a new congressman from the 3rd District in Ohio?
Well, Dayton, Ohio is second only to Detroit this past year in job loss. We've experienced over 4,800 job loss last year alone. And on June 30th, in one day, we're going to lose another 2,666 jobs out of this district. Our congressman has really been asleep at the switch. Apparently, those figures don't bother him. In fact, by the end of the year, in the Dayton Daily News, which is the largest newspaper in the district, they're predicting that we could have over 9,000 jobs lost out of this district.
Oh, 9,000 more?
Total. 9,000 total by the end of the year.
Well, that's a devastating hit to a district like yours. You've got people like Delphi there and NPR and all. Are those companies suffering as well?
Right. Delphi is as you may, your audience may well be aware, is under bankruptcy right now. And if Delphi goes under, that's what's going to push us up to that 9,000 number.
Wow, a big hit. And like you said, second only to Detroit. We have a friend, Tony Tupriano, who's running for Congress up in that area. And we were at the Take Back America conference the other day, and Tony was telling us about the tremendous job loss they've experienced. And Dayton, being a much smaller community, ranked second. My goodness, that's a tough position to be in. What are your programs, Stephanie? What do you want to do to help change this downward spiral we're in right now?
Well, this district has always been a district of innovation and small business manufacturing. I believe we really need to start putting our emphasis on renewable energy. We have a lot of small component manufacturing here that will assist in renewable energy development. We have a number of large universities here in the district that will be able to conduct the R&D needed to, again, help with this new renewable energy technology. It's really the way to go.
Is UD the biggest one, or is Miami University in your
No, Miami is not. University of Dayton is here, Wright State University, Sinclair University, and Wilmington College is in Clinton County.
Okay, I don't think a lot of people understand how many universities and colleges there are in Ohio, a goodly number. It pains me as an ex-Buckeye to take a look at that list of job losses in the country, with Detroit at the top and Dayton next and Youngstown and Cleveland ranking fourth and sixth, respectively. That's a tough one. Ohio's had a rough road to hoe. How are things looking in your campaign right now?
Everything is rolling along great. In fact, right now, I'm involved in a contest on Democracy for America for their national endorsement. And we're vying to, by the end of the day, today at 5 p.m., we need to be in the top five to move on to round two. And if I could put in a little plug, I would love for everybody to get on our website, www.studebakerforcongress.com, and click on the logo on the right to vote for me. This would be a tremendous coup to move into round two and obtain the national endorsement from Democracy for America.
And please explain, what does that Democracy for America endorsement mean to you?
That will mean financial support, and that will mean a lot of tremendous progressive grassroots support to my campaign.
And that's important. A lot of people don't understand about politics. It's somebody like Stephanie running in the 3rd District in Ohio. It's important to have grassroots support from other places around the country as well, as far as donating money and support and so forth. Yes, it is local politics, but it could also take on national connotation as well, and especially in this case. What was that again, Studebaker?
It was www.studebakerforcongress.com.
Have you done any polling? Do you know where you're at in the polls, or is everybody just flying blind right now?
Right now, we're engaged in raising as much money as we can and not spending any money, so we have not conducted any polls. But I don't know if you know this or not, but I am a doctor of veterinary medicine by trade. And what thrust me into this race was, I believe people are tired of career politicians. And we have a career politician at the helm here that has basically left our district in the dust. And I believe it's time for people, you know, average citizens just like me, to step up to the plate and serve as a citizen legislator.
Oh, a lady after my own heart. I rant and rail against career politicians every day on this program. I don't think the founders ever meant for us to have people 20, 30, 40 years in the Congress go do your duty and then come back home. I want to ask you a question that I like to ask all candidates when we talk to them. How do you feel about term limits?
I believe that there should definitely be some term limits associated with Congress. Like you said, you know, having someone serve for 20, 24 years, they lose sight on serving the people, and most especially the United States Congress is the people's branch, and that's what we need to turn it back to, is we need to put it back into the hands of the people.
It's as we've often mentioned, and we've been in the halls of Congress quite a bit, it's easy to understand once you're there that you might want to stay there. It certainly is. It's an exalted position and an important position, and, you know, it's a very interesting position to have. But do your duty and go home. That's what I say after, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I really already have a tremendous life. I have two beautiful little girls, a wonderful husband, a thriving business. I don't need to run. I passionately want to run and serve my country. And it has been ridiculous what is happening in the 3rd District in Ohio, especially in regard to this job loss. We're going to turn Dayton, Ohio into a ghost town if we're not careful.
Well, has the downtown improved any? Last time I was there, it didn't look so good anymore. It was starting to get pretty hard, hit pretty hard in downtown. They were starting a little bit of a revitalization process, I think, but I don't know how far it ever got. All of Ohio has had political trouble this past couple of years with the governor. And have you reached out to Ted Strickland's campaign? Are they going to help you out? Are they going to endorse you? Do you have any ideas as to any of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Congressman Strickland has already endorsed my campaign, and I'm one of only two congressional campaigns that Strickland has endorsed. And the reason being is he believes that, you know, our congressman is vulnerable this time around, and we have the potential to take back this House seat in the 3rd District. And, Congressman Strickland will work hard for me and vice versa in the state.
I'll soon to be Governor Strickland. And
yes, absolutely.
It's looking pretty good for that right now, I think. And I wish you the very best of luck. And I want to do this again. I want to talk about the site where we can all go and click on there so you can get this endorsement. Tell us again.
Okay. This is for the Democracy for America's national endorsement. If you go onto our website, which is www.studebakerforcongress.com, and that's StudeBaker.com, and there's a logo on our website that you click on, and it'll take you right to the spot to vote for me.
I hope we get a lot of clicks on that. Sure had a lot of interest on the program today from Buckeyes, I can tell you that. You mentioned you're a doctor of veterinary medicine. Would you take small animals, farm animals, pets? What do you?
Yeah, currently I am a small animal veterinarian. When I first came out of school, I worked on thoroughbred racehorses out in California, but currently it's just all small animals.
Well, I'm a farm boy, so we always had a close association with our veterinarian. He was a guy who was always the top of our phone book. But now ladies and gentlemen, who couldn't love a lady that takes care of puppies and kitty cats, huh? I mean, running for Congress, who would you rather have in Congress? I Stephanie, I appreciate so much you being on the program today, and I wish you the best of luck in your race. We know that you've been running hard. We've heard from some of your supporters all along that they're very, very passionate about your campaign. And we will mention it as often as we can. And maybe we can have you on again before the election takes place. Thank you.
Guy, I really appreciate you having me on. It was a pleasure, and I'd be happy to come back on your show anytime.
All right. Well, let's get that endorsement for you first. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Have a great day.
Another Democrat running for Congress that we hope to unseat another one of those Republicans. How many is it we have to switch over? What is it, 17 seats that we've got to do? I forget. Don't know why I don't know that number right offhand right now, but I don't have it at my fingertips. But a swell gal. I've heard from her by so many people, and one in particular, Judy, you know who you are, who has been really after me to get Stephanie Studebaker on the program, and I'm so glad I did. I don't know why, in all the background I looked at, I didn't know that she was a doctor of veterinary medicine. Hmm, that's interesting. I don't know how many of those that we have in Congress. Surely not very many. We've got, Lord knows, we've got our number, our quota of lawyers there. So it's kind of refreshing to have someone in a different field there, and someone who, like she said, doesn't need to do it. Well, we're going to stop for a quick break right now. Don't you go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I wanna be just like my president. I wanna make more money than I can spend. I wanna build more bombs than I can send. Somewhere I can even spell the name of. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. I want a big, big Mac and double fries. I want to wave my American standards high. I want to fly my flag across your sky. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Come on, you black and Hispanic boys. We'll keep you poor so you got no choice but to join the army in your prime. We'll fight for Uncle Sam and die. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century. Welcome to the new American century. Yeah, welcome to the new American century.
We're not going to play around. We do have your phone. And if you say anything untoward, obscene, or anything like that, we'll contact your local authorities, and you will be held accountable.
What, you ill-mannered sack of crap?
Tell us what you think. Call Guy James now. 1-866-546-5254.
Yes, indeedy. 866-546-5254. Love to have you call the program today. Especially like some of you new folks to give us a call. You write so often, and so many of you say, I just I'm afraid to call. Call. Well, what do you think? We're going to bite you or something? No, we're not. Interesting, this little farce that the Republicans pulled off in Congress, in the House of Representatives. Did you know that now that we Americans think we can vote ourselves a victory in Iraq? That's what that whole thing was about, that they're going to vote ourselves a victory in Iraq. Absolutely amazing. And there were 42 Democrats that went along with them on that. I will not understand that. I will never understand that. I don't get it. Hey, let's go to the phone. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show. Hello, you're on the Guy James Show.
Oh, yeah. This
Hello.
Is Alice.
Hi, Alice.
I did enjoy hearing again about Roosevelt. Had much to do with the good that he did. That was very interesting. That I knew. I listened to him when he spoke to the families during the Depression.
Well, yes, you remember him, don't you?
That was interesting. Guy, your friend and mine, Tom, is saying that we should no longer use the word war when speaking of what Bush is doing. This is how he is able to compare himself to Truman, Churchill, and Roosevelt. Tom says we should always refer to it as Bush's occupation, and that's what it is.
Well, that's a good idea. I like that. I'll have to retrain myself. That's going to be hard to do.
Yeah.
But you know, you have a point. There is definitely a point to that. It is exactly that. It is an occupation of a sovereign nation. That's what we're doing.
That's right.
And we're kidding ourselves if we think it's anything but that. That's all it ever was, really.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for letting us know that. I'm going to jot that down. I've got to start doing that. You talking about Tom Hartman?
Mm-hmm.
I just saw Tom on Monday and Tuesday of this past week in Washington, so it was good to didn't get a chance to talk to him as much as I wanted to. Tom's an interesting guy. Thank you so much for your call.
Okay,
yeah.
Tom.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah. Have a good day.
Okay. Bye-bye. Yeah, she's talking about Tom Hartman. You know, she's right, and Tom's right. It is Bush's occupation. Let me see if I can train myself to do that. I'm writing this down. We'll see. We are creatures of habit, you know. I've been calling it the Bush War for so long. Scandalous things happening over there right now, and it's things that the average voter just never pays attention to. Did you know that after Bush returned from his trip to Iraq this week, he once again attacked those people, mostly Democrats, calling for a time, well, all Democrats, calling for a timetable for withdrawal. He said Iraqis had concerns that a timetable would disrupt their strategy to create a secure and democratic Iraq. There is, however, one problem with what Mr. Bush said. The Associated Press now reports that Iraq's Vice President Hashimi personally asked President Bush to set a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. forces the day before. And it is they also report that Iraq's President Talabani said he supported the request as well. Iraq's vice president has asked President Bush for a timeline on the withdrawal of foreign forces from Iraq, the Iraqi president's office said. Vice President Hashimi Assouni made the request during his meeting with Bush on Tuesday when the U.S. president made a surprise visit to Iraq. Well. Bush comes home and says one thing, a fat lie, and the Iraqis are going, oh, wait a minute, that's not what was said at all. But, of course, did we expect anything else? Did we really expect anything else? And we have Mr. Cheney at it again, my favorite Dart Cheney, giving a speech saying that the war in Iraq, his words, the war in Iraq preventing attacks here. I guess he just forgot to mention that terrorism has increased fourfold in the past 5 years. And I'm so tired of this. You hear that all the time. Well, there hasn't been an attack here since 2001. Saying that there are no attacks here is would be like Arnold Schwarzenegger claiming he's responsible for there being no earthquakes in California over the past few years. That's the same thing. It's a preposterous claim. Absolutely preposterous. I do get tired of it, don't you? I do really, really get tired of it. And then we've got this matter of the DSCC, and amazingly, I'm trying to find confirmation of this, and I honestly haven't been able to. I've received a flood of reports that the DSCC and Senator Chuck Schumer, who he's chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, has said the DSCC will not rule out supporting Joe Lieberman if he runs as an independent. Can that be true? I've been trying all day to verify that if Schumer actually said that, and I can't. You know, the DSCC's mission is to elect Democrats to the Senate. Yet in this case, would they actually prefer to back an incumbent who's leaving the party instead of a real Democrat, a guy who's proud to be a Democrat? Mark my word. I've said it before, I'll say it again. If Joe Lieberman retains his seat, he'll swing. He'll swing to the other side if it ends up a Democratic majority. He'll do it. You wait. He's that kind of a guy. He is that kind of a guy. And our good friend Glenn Greenwald, uncovered this big lie by Arlen Specter. Whoever thought Arlen Specter would lie? But Glenn Greenwald posted Sunday that he thought Arlen Specter's very public disavowal of the story that his bill would retrofit the FISA Act to provide immunity for the FISA lawbreakers must have meant that Washington Post got the story wrong. But today, Glenn has gotten a hold of a copy of Specter's marked-up bill, and surprise, surprise, it seems that not only was amnesty written into the bill, but also the bill states that anyone spying on Americans with the president's say-so would be deemed to be acting within the law. Senator Specter sure likes to proclaim his love of the Constitution, but he's willing to give a pass to the president in this case, and then is brazen enough to proclaim that he wouldn't do that. Well, anybody surprised? Anybody surprised at all? I'm not. And we've got the story also, and we've been hearing how well all the training is doing is going in Iraq. We're just training these soldiers in Iraq to stand up so we can stand down, although we're not hearing anything about the American soldiers standing down anymore from the Bush administration, are we? You know why? Because they have no plans to stand down. Never did. Never did. They're going to build a permanent occupational mess over there, I guess is what you call it. Building all these military bases, we're going to stay there. We're going to stay there. If these people have their way, we're going to stay there now and forevermore. That's what it's all about. But I had this story. The United Press set it out in Baghdad. You know, they're talking about all this great training we're doing, how we're building up these forces. Hundreds of Iraqi soldiers deserting. Erratic pay, inadequate food, and poor living conditions are driving several hundred Iraqi soldiers out of the army every month. Lieutenant Maktaf Youssef is a company commander in the 4th Brigade of the 7th Iraqi Army Division. U.S. Marines working with the brigade told Stars and Stripes, the U.S. Armed Forces newspaper, that its strength dropped from 2,200 soldiers in December to 1,400 in May. Many of my soldiers, he said, have not gotten paid in 6 months. Sometimes they don't eat for 2 or 3 days at a time. I tell commander, but what else am I supposed to do? Desertions are a major problem in Anbar province, the major stronghold of the insurgency. Well, well, well. They're standing up so we can stand down. Isn't that what we've heard all along? Isn't it? Haven't we just heard that over and over and over again? And folks, I came across a story today that just, it just mortifies me. I am so pissed off at some of this stuff. We talk about how we take care of our soldiers and, you know, we're borrowing money. We're going to end up spending, now they're estimating a couple of $1 trillion. I think that's a dozen zeros beyond. Texas utility to cut off 1,000 soldiers' power. The base is unable to pay bills. Something is seriously wrong here. This is, where did the story come from? Out of a Texas newspaper in San Antonio. Fort Sam Houston has received 1,300 utility service termination notices for delinquent bill payments, which officials blamed on a major budget shortfall. CPS Energy warned commanders at the post to pay $4.2 million by next Wednesday or risk losing power. The post is 3 months behind on its bills, but both Army and utility officials said the two parties were talking and no cutoff was imminent. Who would imagine us not paying our bills, said Colonel Wendy Martinson, Fort Sam Houston's garrison commander. I worry about it. I can't sleep at night. A post commander, a garrison commander, saying she can't sleep at night for fear that they can't pay the electric bill. This is the United States military can't pay the electric bill. And the post commander is losing sleep over it. Yeah, I guess that's part of that strong national security. I guess it is. Well, hey, we're going to pause for a quick break. We'll be right back. And don't go away, because we've got something to talk about. We haven't talked about Mr. Rove in a couple of days, and we're going to do that when we come back.
Colonel Ann Wright, I resigned from the State Department in protest over the war in Iraq the day the war began. I had served in the State Department for 16 years and for 29 years in the U.S. Army and Army Reserves. The war in Iraq was a war of choice, not a necessity for our national defense. The Bush administration now bombs countries rather than speaking to them. We in the Congress were lied to, and we need an investigation of those lies. Please ask your Congress member to impeach George Bush and Dick Cheney for the lies they have told and the dangerous situation they have placed our country in.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
On the last Fourth Estate, we heard from Robert Fisk.
What has now become a habit of compromising on the semantics of reporting in order to avoid criticism. You know, if you call a Jewish settlement or neighborhood a colony, you'll be criticized and called potentially anti-Semitic.
And a little bit of activist history and the Red Scare.
On the line with us right now, we have Kate Fossil, biographer of Ann Braden.
You know, I got interested in Ann's life because of her being a white Southern voice against racism. And
leave it to our listeners to ring up and keep it light.
I don't either. And, you know, Bruce is concerned about the remote control for his DVD player. I mean, I'm thinking about getting rid of the remote control on my blow-up doll. I mean, you know.
What's his name?
I never kiss a tell.
FourthEstateRadio.com.
What do you think tribal sovereignty means in the 21st century? And how do we resolve conflicts between tribes in the federal and state governments?
Yeah. Tribal sovereignty means that. It's sovereign. It means you've been given sovereignty, and you're viewed as a sovereign entity. And therefore, the relationship between the federal government and tribes is one between sovereign entities.
What are you, on dope?
We think so, too. Call Guy James now, 1-866-546-5254.
Hey, if you don't call, well, if you don't call, you don't call. You don't get a chance to get your 2 cents worth in. We'd like to have you call, 866-546-5254. You know, I never didn't get a chance in the past few days to talk about the Karl Rove mess, and it is a mess, and I know a lot of you are very disappointed about it. I'm disappointed about it. I think the evidence shows that the man has had some legal jeopardy, some legal problems, but I guess the prosecutor thinks that he can't get anywhere with it. And I'm going to be fair here. If the prosecutor says he can't get anywhere with it, why, then that's his decision. But here's the deal on Rove. Since his attorney, Ruskin, hasn't released the entire context of the letter from Fitzgerald telling him that Rove is, what he says, no longer in danger of being indicted, one has to wonder if there isn't far more to this story. Now, I'm not going to get into another one of these breathless conversations frothing at the mouth at the prospect of something still being likely to send Rove to the slammer. I think that whole scenario is over with for good. I really do. Rove is not going to go to prison, as much as some of us wish he were going to have the proverbial girlfriend named Bubba. It's just not going to happen, and it probably never was. I think Rove made a deal. I think he made a deal that takes him off the hot seat for good. He's probably going to testify against Scooter Libby and help Fitzgerald send Libby to the slammer for a short while, and I do mean short while. Fitzgerald will hang Libby with this whole thing. Rove is going to be off scot-free. And Cheney, that's the guy I wanted. Cheney is laughing at all of us for even suggesting that that evil son of a bitch might ever have been in legal jeopardy. I bet you a buck he's sitting there having a big whiskey, just laughing his ass off about the whole thing. Fitzgerald most likely threatened Rove and thought old Carl would break down and spill his guts, but you have to look at it from Carl Rove's perspective. Who's one of his best buddies? Junior Bush, the President of the United States. He made Junior Bush. And what would it look like if Junior Bush allowed the guy who installed him into the presidency to go to prison for this silly little plane matter? Wouldn't look good, would it? His chances of going to prison were slim and none, and he knew it. And he used that leverage in talks with Fitzgerald to keep his participation in this whole matter to a minimum. So what if he has to go testify against a former friend and ally? These are Republicans, after all. What else would you expect? You know, rats will actually eat other rats when they get hungry, so there's nothing unusual about this whole affair. I guess the message here is that it's over, folks. Karl Rove is not going anywhere. He doesn't want to go. He'll remain at the helm of the ship of state and guide it in whatever direction he wants to, him and Cheney. His speech making Kerry out to be a cut-and-run coward a couple of evenings ago ought to tell you that. The bastard's going to walk. He knows it. But what chafes me most of all is that Cheney's probably going to walk too. And that's something that really, really is eating away at me. The fact that Cheney's going to end up scot-free out of this whole thing just really, well, that's what I was looking for. I wasn't all that. I was never that worried about Karl Rove. I can't stand the guy and all that. But I was hoping against hope that Dick Cheney would end up on the hot seat. And it just doesn't appear that that's going to happen. It just doesn't. Not to me right now. 866-546-5254. So with that in mind, what do you think about this whole Truth Out and Jason Leopold thing? What do you think about it? Do you think, you know, we've heard from, who was it, his name, Ash, from Truth Out, that Truth Out's going to stand down on this whole thing now? Is that a polite way, an easy way of saying we were dead wrong and that we followed the wrong trail, that we listened to sources that weren't reliable? What is that? What does that mean we're going to stand down on it right now? Does that mean temporarily? Does it mean that Leopold once again made a huge blunder as a journalist? I don't know. I really don't know what it means. I've always respected the work of the folks over at Truth Out. Guys like Will Pitt, my God, tremendous journalist. And Leopold, he's had his problems. But I thought maybe he might be able to vindicate himself with this particular story. And for a while, I don't know, for a while it did look like that he was going to do just that. But right now, I honestly believe the story's over, and I'm sorry to say that. You know I am. But I got to be a realist about it, and I just think the party's over on it. Everybody was talking about Frog marching Rove and Cheney out of the White House. Doesn't look like it's going to happen. At least that's the tact I'm going to take from now on. I'm just going to look at it that way, like it's over with. And if anything does happen along those lines, it'll be a very pleasant surprise for me. A very, very pleasant surprise. I know some of you have talked about this. I received a story about it today about the missing $21 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars in Iraq. That's right, missing $21 billion. Somebody sent me a story from counterpunch.com. It says, during the days of the Nixon Watergate scandal investigation, reporter Bob Woodward was famously advised by his mysterious source, Deep Throat, and we know who that is now, to, quote, follow the money as a way of cracking the story. Well, there is a lot of money to follow in the current scandal that can be best described as the Bush-Cheney administration, and so far, nobody's doing it. My bet for the place that needs the most following is the more than $9 billion that's gone missing without a trace in Iraq, as well as $12 billion in cash that the Pentagon flew into Iraq straight from Federal Reserve vaults via military transports, and for which there has been little or no accounting. Folks, this is a real scandal. When the word of the missing money first surfaced in 2004, Congress passed legislation creating an Office of Special Inspector General, assuming that this new agency would root out the problem and figure out why all that taxpayer money had disappeared and why only minimal reconstruction was going on in destroyed Iraq. Well, what did happen to the money? It's like, it's like putting the fox in charge of guarding the chickens. The Bush administration is going to find out where the missing money was. Yeah, we've heard many, many times that Iraq was awash with $100 bills. So, you know, it's where did the money go? Who knows? Who knows whose hands it's in? Probably the insurgents got a hold of some of it and able to buy. I mean, who knows what's happened to it? Who really knows what's happened to it? I don't know. Disgusting situation. Absolutely disgusting situation. $21 billion of your money come up missing. And now I see they want to, they're really tired. Really tired of the media making an issue of Guantanamo Bay. And the Associated Press is reporting that they're going to start limiting access to Guantanamo Bay. Gee whiz, I wonder why. I just wonder why. It says access has been severely restricted. Journalists cannot talk to detainees. Well, says more than 1,000 journalists have visited Guantanamo Bay since the U.S. military began locking up suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban militants there 4.5 years ago. But access is now being severely restricted. Actually, what's happening right now is the Pentagon has shut down access entirely. Entirely. Expelling all reporters this week. And, of course, that triggered an outcry from human rights groups, attorneys, and media organizations. And, you know, even as we speak, the prison's coming under renewed criticism for the suicides of the detainees last week. A gentleman by the name of Cliff Stafford Smith, an attorney who's filed legal challenges on behalf of about 40 detainees, says now is the time when the media is most needed. The fact that right now, the most important time in the history of Guantanamo, they're being banned is un-American. Well, I hardly agree. I think it is un-American. If you don't keep the light of truth shined on a place like Guantanamo, who knows what abuses may happen, given what we know has happened in several other instances in Iraq and Guantanamo. Who knows what might happen behind locked doors now that there is no one there to give oversight to the entire situation. That troubles me just a little bit. Troubles me a lot. But you know what troubles me a lot more, actually, right now, and I'm still steaming over this Democratic New Direction for America platform put out yesterday by the House of Representatives and by the Democrats. I read it again. I read it on the program yesterday, and I read it again and again and again, and the more I read it, the madder I get. It is inconceivable to me, and I know I said this yesterday, and I may sound like a broken record, but it actually is inconceivable to me that they put out a New Direction for America platform, the Democrats do, and there is no mention of the war, there's no mention of campaign finance reform, and there's no mention of election fraud. How do we trust our politicians now? When they do things like this, how do we trust them anymore? You know, I heard the talking heads going off yesterday talking about how, oh, and they reveled in it, saying, about this booing of Hillary at the Take Back America conference, that the Democrats are divided on the war. I disagree. I don't think Democrats are divided on the war at all. I'll tell you, everybody that I have talked to, I don't believe I've talked to a single person that thinks that we ought to keep troops in Iraq. I don't think I've really talked to a single person, and I talk to a lot of people. And yet the talking heads are on TV last night telling us that the Democratic Party is divided on the war. We are not divided on the war. I'll tell you who's divided on the war. Who's divided on the war? There's a divide between the Democrats and the Democrat politicians. There's where the divide is. the rank-and-file Democrats, the grassroots and netroots Democrats, want us the hell out of there. And yet we've got politicians that don't have the cojones to stand up against the Republicans and get us out of there, or at least try to get us out there, or at least say they want us out of there. Most of them won't even do that now. So there's a divide? No, there isn't. There is not. I would bet you a dollar to a donut that 99.9% of everybody listening to my voice right now is against the war and would like to have our troops come home. There's no division amongst the people out here. There's no division at all. And yet, the Democrats we elected to go to Congress are mum on the subject. For a lot of them are. Most of them are. Yes, we've had our Carries and our Murthas stand up. We've had that. But where's the rest of them? Where are they? And don't give me this excuse. Well, you know, I live in a territory where I can't say a whole lot because I get, you know, crossover votes from there. But I don't give a damn about that. I don't give a damn about your political career. I really don't. You see, you're a representative. You're there to represent the people, not yourself. I don't understand. I don't understand how in the world they could put out this new direction for America and not put those three things on it with the war at the top of the list. I just don't get it. No campaign finance reform, no election fraud mentioned. And as we mentioned, I think we mentioned it yesterday, if there's no oversight on this election fraud, the rest of this thing is trash. Doesn't mean a thing. It means nothing. If we don't have fair elections in this country, the rest of it, it's moot. It doesn't matter. But I don't know. I don't get it. And I just, I'm beginning to think I'm barking up the wrong tree here sometimes. and don't get me wrong. I'm a good Democrat. I'll remain a good Democrat all my life. I'm just wondering who the good Democrats actually are now. That's all. I'm wondering if people we've elected to Congress as Democrats are actually they're supporting us, actually doing the bidding of the people, actually representing us as they're supposed to do. I don't think they've been doing a very good job of it. Not a very good job of it at all. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on the Guy James Show.
Good afternoon, Guy.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Listen, I just had to take and call you today again. Listen, you mentioned Fort Sam Houston, and that's my old stomping ground.
Ah.
And I spent a year there in July and August of 69.
Don't they do a lot of training of medics and that sort of thing there now?
That's right. I don't know about now, but they did then. That's what I was in the Army, was a medic.
All right. Well, hey, I got this little cut on my finger. Well, no, never mind. go ahead and sit.
Listen, I can take care of you.
All right.
But I'll tell you what, the biggest thing I can remember of Fort Sam Houston, I went from Fort Jackson, South Carolina to
that's
Fort
that's
Sam
in Columbia, right? Fort Jackson in Columbia?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I was leaving Fort Jackson, they told there was, I think, maybe about a dozen of us that went in the medics there to Fort Sam Houston. They said, "Oh, man, are you lucky? That's the country club of the Army." Well, I'll tell you what, if that's the country club of the Army, I couldn't see too much difference between that and Fort Jackson.
Really?
Yeah, that's right, but the biggest appointment I think I've had in my entire life, and I'm not exaggerating, was going down to see the Alamo. Jesus.
Everybody got this idea that it's this great big place, don't they?
I didn't see John Wayne. And I didn't see, what was his sidekick there in that movie?
Yeah. I can never remember the actors' names. I remember.
Yeah, Wayne. I'm the same way, but I didn't see none of those guys. And it looked like a hut.
Yeah, isn't that something? The movies, in the first time I saw the Alamo, I was shocked at the size of it.
Was you the same reaction?
Oh, I think my house is bigger than the Alamo. It's really small.
I thought, oh, man, I'm going to go see this. Oh, man, what a waste of time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know.
Listen, don't waste your time.
Yeah, it was interesting. Well, of course, old Davy Crockett was there. And, yeah, I can't remember who played that. Fess Parker didn't play Davy Crockett in that Alamo movie, did he?
I can't remember. Like you said, the actor. I haven't seen that movie for so long.
Yeah, I just
remember that was a big movie. You know, when you was a kid, the Alamo with John Wayne and that in it. But
you know, isn't that something? When we're kids, maybe we have just a completely different perception of things. Maybe we saw the movie when we're really young, and we thought the Alamo was this great big huge fort.
Hey, listen, a guy wanted to ask you a question. You know, this is a kind of off subject, and but I've always wanted to ask you, you know, you said you lived on a farm and had an old farm boy.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever make it down to Central Market in Columbus, Ohio?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Just off of High Street there, yes, absolutely. That old Quonset Hut-style building, you betcha.
That was a big place. When I worked there back in... I think it was 67 or 68 for a guy named Herbie Hannawall. He cut lamb and what else was there? Something else. But I remember I got a job with him. I would walk, about 5 miles and get there at about 5 o'clock in the morning and work for him till about 6 o'clock at night. For $20, and man, I thought that was more money than anything in the world.
Oh yeah, $20.
Oh man, that was a lot of money. But at Central Market, I loved that place.
Oh yeah, and of course, $20. You know, I can remember in college shoveling sidewalks for 50 cents and thinking I had a lot of money.
Yeah. When you mentioned that Alamo, I said I just got to call you back. I don't call. You know, a bunch of times in a week or something. But I said, I couldn't believe that. My wife told me, she says, well, I told you that last night. And I said, well, I must have been tired or something or didn't hear you. But I said, they not paying their electric bill. But I just couldn't believe that base that they're talking about, that's a pretty good size base. They trained the MPs there, or at least they did. The MPs were trained there.
The MPs too. Yeah, I've seen the Fort Jackson in Columbia and have been there. And that's, you know, it's funny that they said you were going to the country club because Fort Jackson's certainly no country club. That's
No, it sure wasn't that. That was pretty tough there at Fort Jackson.
Yeah.
But
that's a big base too.
I like the training that I got in San Antonio at Fort Sam. But that really surprised me when you said that today. I said, oh, God, I just got a call guy in there.
Well, I'm glad you did. Can you imagine they can't pay the electric bill?
I just can't believe that. But where's all this, you know, this money? It's like it's unbelievable what this government's spending. You know, I think it's a plan thing that they want to take in put us as far deep in debt as they can so they can get rid of these programs, kind of like what I was talking to you.
Definitely are going to bankrupt America intentionally. There's, I don't think
it's a shame, isn't it, guy?
Yes, it is. It is.
Well, listen, I'll let you go. I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Well, thanks for calling. I'm glad you did.
I just had to call you.
Interesting to hear your experiences about good old Columbus and Fort Sam. Thanks a lot.
Oh, I love that Central Market. the guy that I used to work next to grooms, they sold all kinds of lunch meat. He had a great big, huge case.
Oh, yeah.
And the groom boys were about 10, 11 years old, and they used to pass me chipped ham and Swiss cheese and bologna.
Oh, now stop it. You're making me hungry.
3 o'clock in the afternoon, you got pretty hungry.
Yeah. Yeah, bring back old memories.
You have a great weekend, you hear?
Yeah, thanks for calling.
All right, take care.
Ah, yes, the old Central Market in Columbus. I do remember it well. I do. And that Fort Sam down there. How many of you have been to Alamo? One of the biggest disappointing things I think I've ever seen in my life. And you know, yeah, I mean the historical significance of it and all that. When you think of Santa Anna's army marching towards it with the horns blowing and the just a few Americans in there, Davy Crockett and Sam Houston and everybody in there defending it. But a little tiny fort. A lot of people just think this is a great big place, but it's not. Little teeny weeny little thing. Hey, don't forget to go to democracyforamerica.com, democracyforamerica.com, and be sure and vote on there for Stephanie Studebaker. Be sure and do that so she can get that endorsement, much-needed money and endorsement for her campaign, and I know she'll appreciate that you do that. So be sure and do that before you do another thing. The show's going to be over here in about 1 minute, and I expect that you will go to democracyforamerica.com and put your vote up for Stephanie Studebaker. I know I'm certainly going to do it as soon as I get done talking to you folks. Hey, you know, we've had an interesting week this week at the Democracy for America conference, and we were, off on Wednesday and back yesterday and today, as always. I want you to know that it's a great thing talking to you each and every day. I consider it a privilege. I appreciate you listening to the program. I do want to remind you that it's a listener-supported program, and we could certainly use some help with the program right now. And let me add that, certainly. So that's about all we have today. I do hope you have yourselves a great weekend. And always remember, you've heard from the radical right. Now all that's left is the truth. Have a good weekend, everybody.